offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the pleasure of joining you from our studios at the Sri Sathya Sai Media Center at Prashanthi Nilayam. A warm good morning to all of you. It's a beautiful Thursday here, and we are here to resume our study of the Bhagavad Gita, which I've had the pleasure of doing with you for the past so many months. We are past the 130th episode, and I can't, as always, express my gratitude enough to Swami for giving me this opportunity to journey with all of you on this beautiful pilgrimage of the Bhagavad Gita. We have completed 9 chapters and we will be beginning the 10th chapter. So effectively, we are moving to the second half of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's, in a certain sense, seems like a dream. We never thought of how long this would take, and but here we are by Swami's grace, and with prayers to Swami, let's begin the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. As we've seen in the earlier chapters, though the discourse of the Gita has been broken into many chapters and they have been given different names, it is not that Krishna was speaking of something earlier and now he is going to say something different altogether. If you recall, at the beginning of the 7th chapter, we had seen how it can be said that the first 6 chapters pertain to the Tvam aspect of the Mahavakya, Tat Tvam Asi, that thou art. So, Tvam means the individual jiva, you and me, what is our true nature. So, the first 6 chapters are spoken of as being a reference to the Tvam aspect. The first chapter is named after Arjuna's sorrow, Arjuna Vishada Yoga, right? And that's the typical characteristic of this Tvam, the Jivatma. Then Krishna speaks of how that Tvam cannot be the body. The second chapter was all about that. It is nothing but the soul wearing the garment of the body, and so on and so forth. So that was the first 6 chapters. The 7th chapter, Krishna speaks or begins to speak about the Tat aspect, the nature of that Supreme Being with whom we are supposed to relate to. In this 10th chapter, Krishna is going to delve deeper into that Tat aspect which he started discoursing on in the beginning of the 7th chapter, and you will find a lot of similarity in certain concepts between the 7th and the 10th chapter. Why should Krishna speak so much about himself? A person who speaks endlessly about oneself, we brand him or her to be egotistical, right? Why should Krishna speak so much just about himself? Well, that will be explained to a certain extent in the first few shlokas, some of which we'll be covering today. But let us for now revisit the context, because as I've always said, it's important to keep that in the back of our mind, because many important spiritual topics are being dealt with in a very deep manner, and it is quite possible that we lose sight of where this fits in, right? So the context of this entire discourse is, it is necessary to keep that in mind even as we go through these various chapters. The context is quite similar to what we've seen at the beginning of the 7th chapter. The context for this particular chapter is very similar to that of the 7th. As we have always maintained, the narrative of the discourse of the Gita is how to sanctify one's life such that it leads one to the supreme goal. How can we plan this journey in such a manner that we don't get distracted by the detours, we don't stop at the wrong destinations, so that this path leads to the ultimate and nothing else? And the methodology for this journey, or the pathway that is being suggested by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, is that of Karma Yoga. That is the basis of the entire discourse. And as we have seen and discussed many times before, Karma Yoga is close to impossible without bhakti. At least I can't imagine selflessly offering all my actions and the fruits of all my actions to God if I don't have love and bhakti towards Him, right? So bhakti becomes a very important feature of Karma Yoga, if I could put it that way. And that bhakti, which is a mix of awe and love, as Swami has described many times in His discourses, bhakti is love for God, at the same time, a little bit of awe and fear towards the Lord, with the understanding of who He is, right? So bhakti is that mix of awe and love. That comes when you are able to picture in your mind the marvelous true nature of God. You have to be made aware of the Lord and how in comparison to Him this entire world with all its temptations pale away in significance. This is the role of whenever the Lord is spoken about. That is the role of Bhagavatam too, isn't it? That is why when we talk about reaching Atma Nivedanam, the Navavita Bhakti, when we speak of, Shravanam is always spoken of as the first step, because through listening, the mind has to be saturated with God and His attributes, and the aspirant, that is you and me, must feel this is much, much more glorious than any worldly achievement that I could aspire for and achieve. So let me pursue Him. That is why the nature of God has to be spoken of by Krishna, and especially when He is discoursing on Karma Yoga. So that the temptations, it's not that they change, it's not that they become any lesser or their nature changes. They continue to be temptations, but they don't tempt us anymore, because now we are tempted with something much, much more higher, right? As we've seen, every chapter in the Gita has a name, and so does this one. The 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is called Vibhuti Yoga. Like the previous chapter, this name itself appears in one of the shlokas, the 7th shloka of this chapter, which we will come to eventually. For Swami's devotees, the word Vibhuti is very dear, and we associate it literally with Swami's grace. We've seen Swami materializing Vibhuti for various purposes, for various occasions, for someone who's celebrating a birthday, to bless a child, of course, for a sick person, or to bless an auspicious event when Swami is consecrating a temple or doing a prana pratishta. Swami would sometimes materialize Vibhuti and put it in the foundation there. But there is a reason why that sacred ash, at the end of the day, it is sacred ash, that Swami used to give was called Vibhuti. And that comes from the essential meaning of this word, Vibhuti. So what does Vibhuti mean? I'm no expert in Sanskrit, nor am I a scholar in scriptures, and I'm sure you'll be saying that, yes, we know that by now. I'm only going to share in general, based on the understanding that I've gathered after reading many sources, what this word Vibhuti means. So I'm not claiming that this is going to be accurate, but of course, I am trying to ensure that it is absolutely consistent with Swami's words. Vibhu means supreme, sovereign, or the eternal, the changeless, or the limitless. This word is used for all of this and much, much more, right? So Vibhu is a word that is used to connote anything in the superlative, something that is limitless, vast, sovereign, great, grand. And needless to say, the only person or entity to whom this word can be assigned as a title is God Himself. Who else can be called the Vibhu, right? So Vibhu means God, or any of these characteristics that connote God: limitlessness, supreme, sovereignty, and all of that. Vibhuti is that which emanates from Vibhu. Not merely something that is created by the Lord, everything, all of creation comes from the Lord. Vibhuti is not merely a creation of the Lord, but that which can be used to perceive or recognize God. Let me give an example to make that clear. You have the sun and you have the sun's rays. If the sun is the vibhu, the sun rays is the vibhuti. Because it is with the light of the sun rays, we are able to behold the sun. We are able to recognize the presence of the sun. How do we know the sun has risen? It is because the rays of the sun reach us. It is through the benefits that we derive from the sun's rays, we are able to understand the glory of the sun, isn't it? So the sun's rays become for us an opportunity to understand the glory of sun. So Vibhuti is that manifestation of the Supreme Lord through which we can perceive and hence recognize and contemplate on the Lord. That is what Vibhuti is. So Vibhuti means the glorious manifestations of the Lord. And these are there all around us, all over the place. In fact, it is a beautiful practice in Sanatana Dharma and even in many other ancient cultures to see anything that is beautiful or awe-inspiring or glorious and relate it to God in some way or the other. There is a tip of a peninsula where three oceans meet and we can literally see different colors of different oceans coming together. We look at it and say, oh wow, this is marvelous. So let's build a temple there. There are seven beautiful hills, each one adding to the glory of that scene. We build a temple there and then we worship the hills as Tirumala. There is a confluence of three rivers. We call it a Triveni. We say this is sacred because this is a glorious phenomenon in nature. And then we perform a worship there, what we refer to as the various Kumbhas and the Pushkaras and all of that. So any scenic spot, beautiful natural formation, a cave that looks very awe-inspiring, a mountain that looks so glorious, a river, a glacier, is seen as an expression of that Vibhu, the Supreme Lord. So these become the Vibhuti of the Lord. If you recall, that is what Krishna had made very clear in the 8th chapter when Arjuna asked about Adidaivata and Adibhuta. Krishna said, I am the Adidaiva, I am the Adibhuta, right? When you see the sun, when you see the elements, you worship them. As I said, anything that is glorious and inspires awe, we associate that with the Lord or a devata or a deity or a superhuman phenomenon, and then we worship it. Krishna said that these are not separate deities. Krishna said, I am the Adidaiva in all these devatas that you see, worship and fear and adore. I am the receiver of all the yajnas. That is why he made that very clear. This means wherever you see a manifestation of something that is glorious, stop, admire it, and understand that it is an expression of the Lord's glory. And you can recognize at that very moment the presence of the Lord. I just said, if the sun is the Vibhu, the sun's rays are the Vibhuti. But what we are seeing here in this Vibhuti Yoga, what we're going to see in this Vibhuti Yoga is the sun itself is the Vibhuti of the Lord who is the true Vibhu. Like that, the water is his Vibhuti, the rains are his Vibhuti, the wind is his Vibhuti, the Akasha is his Vibhuti. Everything that is glorious is a Vibhuti of the Lord through which we can recognize his presence and worship him. And that is also the reason we refer to the sacred ash that you receive in a temple or when Swami used to materialize Vibhuti for his devotees. That is why we refer to that as Vibhuti. Because the prasadam is nothing but the concretization of divine grace, isn't it? When you go to a temple and come, people come and ask you, have you got any prasadam? And go to any South Indian temple, you have to come back with Vibhuti and Kumkum. Why is that? Because that is a means by which I am bringing the grace from the temple to a person who did not visit the temple himself or herself. Swami's grace is, was, and will always be there with us. But we are unaware of it. And when we are aware of it, it gives us a lot of solace, it gives us a lot of peace, right? So we seek a means by which that grace can be carried in a concrete form. That grace can be seen as being manifest and thereby be aware of it. Some of the old devotees would say, when they leave Swami's presence, they would insist on vibhuti from Swami's hand. And they would say that, no, this should be materialized vibhuti. As Brother Giridhar was saying the other day, in the olden days, they used to refer to it as kai vibhuti, which means it is coming from Swami's hand. The devotees used to say, separate the vibhuti that is made and packed from the vibhuti that would come directly from Swami's hand. They would say that, if you have to receive Swami's grace, you should get Swami's kai vibhuti from his own hands and not the vibhuti that is packed. Because they saw that as a concrete form of his grace that they could carry with him and feel his presence. Whenever Swami would materialize anything, be it a ring, a chain, a watch, or whatever it is, Swami would say, this is the very purpose of that. My grace is always with you, but when you look at these objects, you are aware that my grace is always with you. In the later years, Swami would give vibhuti packets to devotees, and that would be seen as an act of grace, right? Did you get the packet from the stores or did you get it directly from Swami? When Sevadals used to complete their seva and prashanti and would return, Swami would give them padnamaskar and give vibhuti with his own hands. Right? So they were seen as Swami giving his grace. When we were students, if Swami wants to send us home, either during the vacation or after we have finished our studies, Swami would call and give us vibhuti. And once vibhuti is given, there can be no argument and no discussion after that. You have taken the prasadam, you have to leave. So that's how the sacred ash gets the name vibhuti. Because vibhuti is a form in which you can perceive that grace. But vibhuti itself is not to be restricted just to that sacred ash or that which comes directly from Swami's hand. And that is the idea that Krishna is going to convey in this chapter. Vibhuti is also referred to as an expression of a divine person. Right? Just for the academic purpose, I will mention that also. When the Lord comes as an avatar, how do you recognize him? Or when there is a divine manifestation in the form of a human person, how do you recognize that person as being different from the other mortals that we move around with? Through some of these superhuman powers, that person manifests, right? So vibhuti is also used to refer to the 8 powers or Ashta Aishwaryas or something like that, through which an avatar or a divine amsha of the Lord can be recognized. These are called sometimes even Ashta Siddhis, right? Anima Siddhi, Lagima Siddhi, Mahima Siddhi, Prapti Siddhi, Prakami Siddhi, Ishita Siddhi, and so on and so forth, right? These are not relevant for what we are discussing here. That's why I'm just mentioning them and not going deeply into them. Because Krishna is not merely speaking about recognizing a divine personage, right? That's not the idea. He's talking about recognizing and acknowledging divinity in our everyday experience. He is actually going to re-emphasize here what he has already told in the 7th chapter, where he said, I am the effulgence in the effulgent, I am the strength in the strong, and so on and so forth. What is the reason for Krishna to reiterate this point again and again? Yes, as I mentioned, that for Karma Yoga to have devotion is important, to have devotion, to be educated about the glory of the Lord is important. But why repeat it again and again? Why not just mention it in one chapter and then get on with it? Why should Krishna reiterate the point again? I will maybe talk about that after we listen to the first shloka of this chapter, because Krishna himself confesses in this first verse that he's going to repeat himself. So we will listen to the first verse of the 10th chapter. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail. As always, Brother Shyam has very clearly and beautifully rendered the shlokas for us. We are ever grateful to him for that. We will listen to the first shloka of the 10th chapter.
Shri Bhagavanuvacha Bhuya Eva Mahabaho Shrinu Me Paramam Vachaha Yatteham Priyamanaya Vakshyami Hita Kamyaya.
The Blessed Lord said, O Mighty Armed One, listen again to my utterance on the Supreme, which I, wishing your welfare, shall speak to you who takes delight in it. So that's the first verse of the 10th chapter. We're officially into the second half of the Bhagavad Gita with that. Krishna begins this chapter by referring to Arjuna as Mahabahu, O Mighty Armed One. It is an appellation that is used to praise someone's prowess. If I look at you and call you, O Beautiful One, or Hey Mr. Handsome, I am paying you a compliment in the act of calling out to you itself, isn't it? In that sense, when Krishna calls Arjuna Mahabahu, he is referring to an admirable quality that Arjuna possesses. But the idea is, Krishna is going to tell Arjuna that all these qualities in you are not to make you feel proud, but they should remind you of me. We'll come to all of that in a bit. That's going to be the subject of the chapter itself. First, we will look at a few other things that Krishna is stating here. Mahabahu, O mighty armed Arjuna, Bhuyaha eva, again indeed, Shrinu me paramam vachaha, listen to my words about the Supreme. Me paramam vachaha means my supreme words. But when we look at it in the context of the chapter, what Krishna has spoken before, we can say that Krishna is saying, listen to my words about the Supreme, the limitless especially. So he says, me paramam vachaha. So in Krishna's own admission, he is repeating something that he has said before. And as we go through, we will see obvious similarities with the 7 chapters I just mentioned. But if anything, Krishna asserts those points more firmly in this chapter. So Krishna says, Bhuyaha eva. I am going to repeat again. Now at least I don't have to be so guilty about going on repeating myself, right? Even then, when I repeat myself, that is because my knowledge is limited. I know only little things, and if you ask me to speak so often, I will speak the same things in different ways, right? But why is Krishna repeating himself? He has all knowledge. He is limitless. Why should he repeat a topic? As we saw, Vibhuti means the expression of the Vibhu, or the limitless Lord. That Vibhu is present in each one of us as the Atma. And all excellence, talent, energy, abilities, intelligence that we find in us is nothing but a Vibhuti, the glory of that Vibhu being expressed. As I said, Krishna calls Arjuna Mahabahu. In the 11th verse of the 7th chapter, Krishna had said, Balam Balavatam Maham. I am the strength of the strong. So though Krishna is calling Arjuna, O mighty armed one, that might in his physical presence, without telling, Krishna is saying, that might in you is me, or it is my Vibhuti, it is my expression of my glory. Now there is another word in Sanskrit which can be looked at as an antonym of Vibhuti. But the usage of that word is quite different. I'll mention that also later. But if you look at it from the point of view of the word itself and how vibhuti is, vibhu's expression is vibhuti, the antonym for vibhuti becomes anubhuti. If vibhu means the limitless, anu means the limited. Vibhu refers to the divine atma within. Anu is that idea that I am just this body or that ego sense, right? Anubhuti then is the expression of that idea of limitedness. If vibhuti is the expression of the unlimitedness, anubhuti is the expression of the idea of limitedness. In some Indian languages, we use the word anava or anavam to mean ego. It comes from this idea that I am this anu, I am this one individual entity. The word anubhuti is used generally to mean experience, right? Even in some of the Indian languages, we use the word anubhuti to refer to experience. Experience that is gained by the physical means of perception. I see it, I heard it, I have come to this conclusion, right? Anumana, we say, this is my conclusion. But the root of this word, as I understand, means the qualities that are born of this feeling that I am this individual. That's why whenever we speak of experience, we are only speaking about the experience of this body-mind complex. That's why probably we use the word anubhuti. So when you look at the difference between vibhuti and anubhuti, vibhuti is here to tell you that you are connected to the Lord. Anubhuti, on the contrary, is a divisive power. So when, say, my intelligence or my talent is actually a vibhuti of the Lord, a manifestation of His grace, my ego steps in and claims that I am the intelligent one. I am very talented. And thereby it leads to pride, isn't it? And that pride makes me move further away from my reality. But the more I learn to recognize all that is good in me to be a vibhuti of the Lord, the lesser I am likely to get carried away by my ego. I am rich, all glory goes to Bhagwan. I have a photographic memory, I keep reminding myself it is nothing but Bhagwan's glory. I am an amazing singer, I remind myself this talent is an expression of His glory. And this I have to keep reminding myself again and again, because as long as we have the ego, it will try to claim what is vibhuti as anubhuti, as an expression of who I am. I am talented, I am rich, I have worked hard and I have built this empire, this business. And that is why this has to be repeated over and over again as long as the ego exists. Most of us have this habit of saying, it is all Swami's grace. When someone comes and says, oh, you've done this really well, or you're very good at this, or you're amazing, we always say it's Swami's grace. I think I'd mentioned this earlier too. Once some of the MBA students had the opportunity to be sitting around Swami, I think it's the first batch of MBA students, and they asked Swami this question, Swami, are we here in Swami's presence, in Swami's institute, because of merit, or is it purely because of Swami's grace? And Swami, with a very sweet smile, said, merit also is grace only, sir. For some of us, grace comes directly, where we really academically don't deserve to be in Swami's institute, and Swami steps in and Swami says, okay, I'm giving you the seat. For some of us, Swami puts the intelligence in our mind and we excel through the exam and the interview and come in. But even that is grace only, sir, in Swami's words. So when we attribute our talents, achievements, goodness, so on and so forth, everything to Swami, it is not just humility. It is honesty. It is the truth that we need to remind ourselves. Because there is benefit in that for us. That is why Krishna says in the next line, Vakshyami, I will declare it to you. Hitakamyaya, very beautifully he says, Hitakamyaya, with the desire for your welfare. Kamyaya means desiring. Hitakamyaya. Hita means welfare or benefit. Hitakamyaya means with the desire to bring welfare to you. By repeating and explaining the Lord's vibhuti, there is benefit for you and me. God does not get anything out of it. I am an extremely wealthy person. What does God gain by saying that that opulence of yours belongs to me? It is my vibhuti. What does God get by that? Or I am a poet and God says that all your creativity, you know, it actually belongs to me. There is nothing for him to gain from it. He is only but revealing the truth in this entire chapter, which is called the Vibhuti Yoga. Hita Kamyaya, only with the desire to bring hita to you and me, to bring welfare to you and me. Krishna also makes another statement in the shloka. He says, Yat te aham priyamanaya vakshyami. I shall speak to you about this because you seem to be delighted with what I say, or you are showing interest in what I say. This is what Krishna is telling Arjuna. Krishna is hinting that I can see a change of heart in you. Sometime back, Krishna was not telling things that Arjuna wanted to hear, isn't it? When he said, I want to leave the battlefield and go away, I will become a sannyasi, I don't want kingdom, I don't want to be a ruler. He thought Krishna will pat him on his back and said, oh, amazing, you're so selfless, you're a very noble person. So when Krishna started calling him, oh, you coward, and started saying, you should fight, and this is not, leaving the battlefield is not a spiritual act that you're doing because you have no idea what is spirituality. Arjuna didn't want to hear these words. But now slowly as Krishna is explaining to him what he meant in that second chapter or in the beginning, in the end of the first chapter when he said all those harsh words in the second chapter, right? When he said all those harsh words, why Krishna said that, when Krishna is explaining himself, now Arjuna is beginning to see the point. He is beginning to appreciate what Krishna is saying, and Krishna is himself acknowledging that by saying, as you seem to be pleased with my words, I will speak about the glory of the Lord and I will speak about it again. And I am not doing this because I will get anything. Krishna is not looking at Arjuna and saying, oh Mahabaho, whatever might you have, it is mine. He is not looking at him and saying, oh, you are the most talented archer in this entire universe. That talent is my vibhuti. The Lord gets nothing but nothing by claiming our talents and our abilities and our goodness. We gain when we recognize this fact that all that is good in me is nothing but His vibhuti. What a beautiful thought it is. Everything that is good in me is nothing but an expression of my Lord from within. That is why this chapter is so beautiful and so important, because this vibhuti, this acknowledgement of vibhuti, is the only way this anubhuti can be countered. This feeling of, this is mine. I am the talented one. I am the beautiful one. I am the more intelligent one. That can be counted only by this acknowledgement of vibhuti. We'll go to the second verse and we'll see what Krishna is saying in that one.
Name vidussuraganah prabhavanna maharshayah ahamadirhi devanam maharshinam cha sarvashah.
Neither the host of the gods nor the great seers know my power. Indeed, I am the only source of the gods and the great seers. That is the second verse of the 10th chapter. Krishna is talking about his glories because it is beneficial for us to know, and it is good if we are reminded of it repeatedly. That's why he is repeating it. But still, why should he himself speak about it? When I myself speak about myself, and I say, so imagine that I meet you and say, hey, you know, I'm very good at this. You know, I'm a phenomenal cook. Oh, nice to meet you. I'm a very good speaker. How would that be? You always want your praise to be spoken about somebody else, right? That somehow has a more genuine ring to it, isn't it? You don't meet someone and, I mean, somebody comes and says like that, we always take a step back and we're on guard. This person doesn't seem to be sending out the right vibes. So why should Krishna, he himself, speak about it? It seems a bit egotistical. Krishna could have told somebody else to speak about his divinity. He could have called sage Narada and said, oh Narada, explain about me. Or called sage Vedavyasa and told, you tell Arjuna about me. And he does do that too, right? It's not that is not done. In Swami's presence, we've seen so many great devotees and elders. Even as Swami is sitting there silently, they would stand next to Swami and speak about Swami's glory, right? So that also is done. But why should the Lord himself speak about himself? Krishna explains that in this verse. He says, Name Veduhu Suraganaha Prabhavam Namharshaha. Me Prabhavam, my glory, my majesty, Viduhu, is known na suraganaha na maharshaha, neither to the gods nor to the maharishis. No one else knows completely my glory. How can anyone know? Aham adihi hi, I am the source, the origin, verily, devanam maharishinam cha sarvashaha. I am the origin for the devas, the maharishis, and for everyone. The Purusha Suktam says that this marvelous creation with this universe that spans a size that can't even be comprehended by our mind. The universe is so massive, and now you speak about many universes. Krishna spoke about the many lokas. All of this, the Purusha Suktam says, is a manifestation of a fraction of his glory. However knowledgeable they are, how can they know his glory? Those who are a part of this fraction, who are a tiny fraction of this fraction. I always say this to people who ask me, how do you know Swami is God? Or how can you say that he is God? The answer I give is, how can I? I can't. Do I know God before to be able to recognize him? I've seen an aeroplane and I've seen it up close. So if I happen to be in a village where no one has seen an aeroplane and this aeroplane just happens to fly across the sky and everybody looks at it and says, oh wow, that's amazing, what is that? I can tell them with confidence, oh, that's an aeroplane, that's a machine that flies. I can tell them what it is because I have seen it before. So have I seen or known God before to be able to recognize him when he comes to me in the form of Satya Sai Baba or any other form? Once I was seeing this interview of an old student, a student of Swami's Vrindavan College, one of the first few batches. The interviewer asked him, who is Swami to you? And very promptly he said, he is the Supreme Lord, the master of this entire universe, Parabrahman. Then the interviewer asked, but how do you know? And he gave the most simple and the best honest reply. He said, because Swami says so. Because no one else can reveal it to us. Every experience in this regard is limited to our mind, to what our mind is capable of experiencing. And as Krishna says here, the entire creation and the jnanis and the rishis, those who have this enormous amount of knowledge, have been created by him, and all their experience and knowledge is contained in a fraction of his manifestation. In the previous chapter, Krishna had said, the creation, however expansive it may be, it is like the wind, the unlimited, unfettered wind, which moves from one continent to another, but yet still moves only within the akasha or space. So in that manner, all devas, maharishis are contained within him. Their knowledge and intelligence shine, but because of him. Aham adihi. I am the source, Krishna says here. There is no way for them to know and thereby explain it to others. During the 1974 Samakos, one of the last discourses that Swami delivered was a discourse that he delivered about himself. The title of that discourse itself, you see, look it up in the Samashawa's book. It is, Who is Satya Sai Baba? He describes his nature in that. Those of you who have watched the panel discussion that we did during the Aradhana time, we had played a poem of Swami where Swami describes himself very, very beautifully. That poem is from this particular discourse. So after speaking about him and his nature, towards the end of the discourse, Swami says this, and I quote, he said, I wanted to convey to you some aspects of Sai which many people want to know, although it is not possible for anyone to understand or fathom the depths of Sai's divinity. This is the background of my wanting to talk about myself. I wish to convey to you some things which others cannot convey. End of quote. So one thing, there is benefit in knowing about the nature of God. There is hita in it. And the nature of God is going to be described in a manner that he can be recognized in daily life and experience. And lastly, there is no one who can do it better than the Lord himself. So Krishna says, I will do it myself. And I do it because, Arjuna, I find you are a receptive listener to what I am here to say. I see you delighting in my words, and so I will reveal it to you. So Krishna is saying, nobody can know me, nobody can understand me, and when you don't understand something, you cannot talk about it. And without understanding something, if you try to talk about it, we all know what happens. But what happens when somebody becomes aware of the nature of God? What happens when this knowledge is truly attained? That, of course, we have come across that many times before. Krishna reiterates that again here in the third verse. We listen to the third verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will see what Krishna is saying there.
Yo ma majamana dincha veti loka maheshwaram asammoodhas samartyeshu sarva papaih pramuchyate.
He who knows me, the birthless, the beginningless, and the great Lord of the worlds, he, the undeluded one among mortals, becomes freed from all sins. So that's the third verse of the 10th chapter and the last verse we'll be discussing today. There is no one to know me, so there is no one to really talk about me or explain my nature to you about me. Even when we hear about divinity from Krishna himself, or when we heard from Swami, our understanding of what Swami is or what the Lord is limited. We can understand only as much as we have the capacity to understand. Our mind is, truly speaking, not capable of understanding the infinite, right? But having said that, this process of trying to understand the nature of God is essential. And what does this process do? It eventually sublimates the mind. The mind literally is the seat where the ego exists, right? The mind's effort to understand is, as we say, like the salt doll making an attempt to measure the depths of the ocean. the process may be vain in the sense that there is no possibility of such an expedition being successful. But the gain of such an expedition is much, much more than what was intended as the goal of that effort. So Krishna states here, the same reason because of which no one can tell you about me is the very reason why this knowledge is necessary. Krishna says, Yaha, those who veti, know, mam, me, ajam, anadimcha, the unborn and the beginningless. Ajam, anadim, I am unborn and I am beginningless. Descriptions of God we have come across right from the beginning of the second chapter. He doesn't have a birth, ajam, meaning he is causeless. He is the cause of this entire universe, the entire creation. He is the causeless cause of this entire creation. And since he is ajam or birthless, he is anadim, doesn't have beginning. Yo mam ajam manadim cha veti loka maheshwaram, and also knows me as Loka Maheshwara, the great lord of the worlds. If you gain true knowledge of the Supreme, you will not think of him as Brahma, Vishnu or Maheshwara. You will think of him as Loka Maheshwara. You will not think of him as being Rama, Krishna or Swami or even Satya Sai Baba. You will realize that he is way beyond these forms. The images of Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, as Swami would tell us, is nothing but a creation of human imagination. Swami would say, the great Ravi Verma imagined them like that and he drew his pictures. And having worshipped such pictures in our altar right from our childhood, we think that God must be like that. He should have four arms, should be standing on this, he should be holding this. This should be his vahana and all of that. You may ask, all right, that you can say that about Rama, Krishna, Vishnu and Shiva and all of that. But what about Swami? His form is not an imagination. We have seen that form. We can see that form even now. There are enough number of pictures and videos taken. But if we think of God only as that 5 feet 3 inch form, then we think that he came into existence in 1926 and then that form disappeared in 2011. He was born to a lady called Ishwaramma, a father called Pedda Venkamaraju. He lived in this town called Prashanthi Nilayam and so on and so forth. But what is Krishna saying here? He is Aja, unborn, Anadi, does not have a mother or father. He has no cause. And this name and form of Satya Sai Baba is only a brief appearance on the scene. And he is Loka Maheshwara, the supreme master of all beings and all realms. What happens when this knowledge dawns? Asammoodaha sa. He is undeluded, or he sheds his delusion. I just said, if we will not imagine God to be any particular form, not even restrict him to the form of the beautiful form of Swami, because that name and form is only a brief appearance on an eternal substratum, the Adhara. And when this knowledge is had, we will also come to understand that the name and form that I hold presently, that you hold presently, are also brief appearance on something that is constant. As it is said, the mind will turn from the form of the pot to the essence of the pot, which is the clay. So this knowledge of God has the ultimate hita, or the ultimate benefit of becoming or of making you asammoodaha, free from all kinds of delusion. Krishna adds, asammoodaha sa martyeshu. He is the undeluded one amongst mortals. He continues to be a mortal. That doesn't change the body and the mind, the composition of the nature of the body and the mind. Even the avatar comes, the body goes through that course of what a body is meant to go through. But even though he is Martyeshu, in this mortal world, he becomes a delusion-free person. The delusion is dropped. Sarva papaihi pramuchyate. The person is thereby liberated from all the sins. And here, sins also include what we refer to as punya. When we speak of life in this mortal world, there is right and wrong. Right leads you to punya, wrong leads you to papa, merit and sin. But when we talk about delusion, when we talk about delusion, what is the fundamental delusion? When I say I am tall, when I say I am young, or I am old, or I am sick, Swami says this I am is nothing but aham, right? The true I in each one of us is the Atma. But when I say I am and add a physical attribute or a trait to it, that is where the delusion, the root of the delusion lies. What is Atma, I am seeing as Anatma. What is the Supreme, I am seeing as mundane. And anything that adds to that delusion becomes a sin when you look at it from this point of view. When you look at it from the point of view of within the world, within the society we live in, something is a sin, something is a merit. And even that within the societies that we have created, there is a law for each land. What is a sin in the Europe? If I'm going to drive left side in the Europe, it's a crime. I will be arrested for that. But what is a crime there is a rule here. I have to drive on the left side. So within this world, we have created right and wrong based on our boundaries, man-made boundaries of cities and jurisdictions and countries. But when we look at it from the point of view of delusion, doing good and doing bad both equally add to delusion, right? So when you look at it from the point of view of that delusion that we are referring to, even punya and papa are equally seen as sins. So when Krishna says here, sarva papaihi pramuchyate, this papa includes even the good that we do. Because as long as we think, I am doing the good, there is the assertion of the doership, right? So the doership, I mean, these are all points that we've been speaking of so many times before, right? So Krishna says that that doership will fall because the delusion has been uprooted. We could have taken up the next shloka, but the next shloka and the one that follows after that are to be done together. They're actually one full statement. So we will do it the next time we meet. From the next shloka, Krishna is going to directly start speaking about this. Many divine manifestations, not merely as an avatar. How do you recognize this manifestation in yourself, in society, in the people we meet, right? Manifestation of the Supreme Lord, not as an avatar, but as vibhuti, qualities and attributes, effulgent ones, right? Vibha means that which shines. So vibhuti means that effulgent expression of that Supreme Lord. So various traits are going to be spoken about by Krishna and say that these are all things that should remind you about me. This itself is a very, very beautiful concept and very powerful message that Sanatan Dharma gives. Swami would often say that we ridicule some of these practices that we do. We take all the effort to go to some shrine which is so cut off, somewhere nestled in the in the interiors of the Himalayas. But there is a reason why some of these things are done, right? This is not merely Sanatan Dharma alone. One of our lecturers who returned from a visit to a few European countries where he participated in some of the retreats which were held there, he came back and he said this, you look at the various places of worship, you look at these beautiful churches, these grand mosques, you see these chapels, and you look at it and you see that this desire of humanity to offer to God the best of what it had is a constant phenomenon or a continuous phenomenon that you can see across cultures. It was because inherently we knew that anything that was glorious was reminding us of the Lord and is meant to remind us of God. And it is not that God is sitting there and wants you to remember Him. It is not that God is sitting there and saying, nobody remembered me today, nobody offered me any worship, nobody offered me their actions. God does not gain by all of this. God does not gain by claiming what is yours as His. We gain when we acknowledge that whatever that is good in me is nothing but a manifestation and expression of the Lord. And that is why this 10th chapter that we've started today is so beautiful. And this entire 10th chapter is eventually going to lead up to Krishna showing His true form to Arjuna, which happens in the next chapter, of course. But this is the build-up to that. That Krishna is going to see that, Krishna is going to tell Arjuna that everything that you see around is nothing but calling out to you to remind you of me. We will conclude with that here, dear listeners. Thank you for being with me. I most humbly offer this effort at Bhagwan's Lotus Suite. A short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment, Outside Inside Deep Inside. At 12, I will join you with Sai Prakash for the afternoon satsang. We are going to continue with our summarizing or picking out a few highlights from the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. So do join me at 12, me and Sai Prakash, for that episode. Till I meet you next time at 10 a.m. for the next episode of the Gita series, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.